Have you ever wondered what happened to legendary Chuck Norris? He's in his 80s and still is kicking butt and working out and staying active. What's even more shocking is he's stronger, can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, her body looks leaner, and she has energy all day. Chuck's made a 20-minute video explaining step by step how anyone can do the same thing to see incredible changes in their health. Go to mymorningkick.com/SOG and watch Chuck's video right now. Again, that's mymorningkick.com/SOG.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each, then get flavorful Tyson natural boneless chicken breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is SOGcast number 12. My name is John Stryker Meyer, and I'm here today as your host for SOGcast number 12. And with this production is coming to you courtesy of Jocko Willink Productions and his right-hand man, Echo Charles. And of course, today we're also joined by our secret technician here, Tom. Good morning, Tom.
Morning.
And so with that, I'm going to turn to Across the Fence. This talks a little bit about our secret war. And this was in May 1968. A team had been extracted from an LZ, a landing zone, but it wasn't clear if the entire team was out or not. And so on that occasion, the King Bee, a South Vietnamese helicopter, was ordered to return to the LZ, and on it, we had one staff sergeant, Robert J. Parks, who was on that helicopter going into the LZ. And because no one had radio covey to indicate the team was clear from the target, Spider directed the chase ship to land on the LZ to ensure that ST Oregon was extracted successfully. It was also a last act of desperation. He had hoped against all odds to see Lane, Robert Duval Owen, or one of the Vietnamese team members of ST Idaho. No one saw. Spider jumped aboard the H-34 as a mortar round exploded in the bomb crater and dozens of weapons fired upon the King Bee. As the chopper was lifting off, the door gunner sitting next to Spider Parks was killed. And this was one mission on one day, May of 68. And today it is my extreme pleasure to introduce Robert J. Spider Parks to SOGcast number 12. Spider, welcome to the SOGcast.
Thank you, Till.
And we started in the middle of one of those exceptional days where we didn't talk about ST Idaho, but at that time we had recon teams. Previously, you had been on a member of Spike Team Idaho. You had run several missions with that team. Glenn Lane was the 1-0.
That's right.
And at that point, you had been promoted to your own team. You earned a new promotion. So you get transferred from Idaho. Lane goes out with a new team member, Robert Duval Owen. And that team goes missing in action May 22nd, 1968. And they remain missing in action today. They are amongst the 50 Green Berets from the secret war in Laos, Cambodia, and amongst the 1,583 Americans who are still missing in action today in Southeast Asia from the secret war. So getting back to that day, the standard operating procedure, if a team disappears or is in severe trouble, there's a bright light. and a bright light is an emergency insertion by a recon team. In this case, it was Spike Team Oregon with George Sternberg, who, if you haven't seen it, was on Sogcast 1. And he talked about that day in extensive detail from his point of view. He was with Mike Tucker and Steve Perry, were the Americans with four or five indigenous troops from Spike Team Idaho. They went in looking for Idaho. They found no one. They had heavy contact. Everybody was wounded. They had one of their team members was killed in action. The team was pulled out, and this was the scene where you go in, and that moment in time, just one day, where you're riding in the chase ship. And we've never heard your side, but that brief time on the ground, I can't imagine all the bullets being shot around you as you went over. Can you talk a little bit about how you landed and then what you saw or didn't see? And of course, like we said, you were hoping to see somebody from Idaho, but you didn't.
Well, Tilt, let me back up a little bit.
Please do.
I was still assigned to RT Idaho. My promotion was pending. I was to go down to another FOB and take charge of what they call a Leloy team. Leloy was a famous warrior in the old Vietnamese tribal wars. And I hadn't left the compound. I was still assigned to RT Idaho. I was supposed to go on that mission, and Lane said, "Spider, you're getting promoted. You get ready to go down to Kontum, and Owen is ready." And Owen had trained with us. He'd had another tour and ahead of that, and was ready to go. And Lane said, "You know, you need to stay here and prepare to go. This, you know, I'll take Owen." Owen was ready, so I was okay with that. And then when we didn't hear from them, I became adamant that I wanted to go. And then Colonel Bill Shelton said, "Spider, you can go on the chase ship." I said, "Okay, that'll be enough." And that's why I was on the chase ship. And of course, I had a radio. But I could only pick up the Fox mic. I couldn't hear the UHF and the VHF for the SPADs and of course
Covey.
My Vietnamese wasn't good enough. It was good enough to tell the pilot, "We go down now." Anyway, the LZ, there was plenty of smoke down there, but we landed, we came in, and...
Just for clarity, you told the King Bee to go down after Sternberg was out. So that team is out.
No.
But you didn't know it. Where were you?
They were still on the ground.
Okay.
And we didn't know, and I didn't know what the
situation
aviators were talking about.
Right.
And then I'd heard that... A Fox mic broadcast that, you know, the King Bees were coming in for pickup. So we were right behind them. And of course, Sternberg and the team were at the bomb crater, I believe. And he had Steve Perry, because I think Tucker was wounded also. But there was some confusion there, and then...
And Steve was seriously injured.
Yep.
He was paralyzed from the waist down at that moment from a hand grenade.
He had one of the M26s or concussion grenades that had landed in there. But I landed about 40 meters from that bomb crater and was running over the other toward them when he had tossed... Steve Perry on the aircraft, and he had been shot in the arm. I could see him waving, and it looked like that he was flipping him off with his free hand.
And Sternberg got shot in the right arm.
In the right arm.
But he's left-handed.
He's left-handed.
So he's shooting, and he still found time to flip the bird to the NVA. That's one of those golden moments in Sox history.
And, of course, I talked to Sternberg after that, but after that incident, they were all medevaced back to Fubai. I had some shrapnel in the arm and stuff. It was minor stuff. And they couldn't take me at the FOB because the dispensary was full. And they took me off down to the MASH unit down the street. Bill Shelton was on the PSP pad when we came back to Fubai, and he said, "Hey, Spider, you go on down there and take care of that shit." So, and that's what it was.
But, yeah.
And then I came back and found out that they had been further medevac down to Da Nang, or I don't know if they went all the way back to Camp Zama, but about a month later, we went down to be interviewed by some intel types down in Saigon. And Saigon had been recently hit with a sapper attacks. And we stayed at the safe house, or I stayed at the safe house.
House 10.
And then I went out to the Tonsonut, to the liaison board, where Pappy Webb was out there, and I knew I could get some alcohol and poker. So I went in. They didn't really want to talk to me much about what went on in the white bright light LZ.
Okay.
But I gave them that report. I don't know what happened to it.
So let's back the tape up a little bit further then. When did you land in South Vietnam? And this is after, of course, just for the record, you and I met in the summer of 1967 at A Company, Special Forces Training Group, along with Tony Harrell, Rick Estes, Rick Howard, and a few other luminaries, Ron Owens. But we went through training group together. You and I played on the same softball team with Tony, and we played against John McIntyre from Company B. Beat them profoundly. So, and thanks to your pitching skills, and so we knew each other from training group, and so when you landed in Vietnam, I was still going through some TDY training back in the States. But when did you land in Vietnam? And when did you get assigned up to FOB one?
I landed in Vietnam just after Tet of
68.
And I had gone VOCO up to FOB1 by way of FOB3 in Quezon. And I had been reading about Quezon in the front page news of
every day
this siege.
Sure.
And I said, that's why my dad said, don't volunteer for nothing. And at any rate, I met Troll Sternberg up there a few days before I was able to get out of Quezon. That is another experience that I was so glad I was assigned to FOB1.
Wow, how long were you at Quezon? I mean, FOB3
about
was...
about a week.
That's a week too long, right?
Well, yes, it was. I could tell you a little story of what happened. I was on a King Bee, and I had an M16 and a duffel bag full of new sterile fatigues that had no red dirt on them. And I looked around. The guy that was on the chopper with me was a guy named Valentine, and he looked completely red dirt and mud, and he needed a shave. And
the red dirt was from Quezon, red dirt.
Yeah, that from Quezon. He'd been down to Saigon and was coming back up. Anyway, here's what it's like. The helicopter said, "We go down now," and they just, it's like being on a roller coaster. They go down. And then about 12 feet, 10 feet off the ground, I saw my duffel bag go out, and it's going end over end. I looked around and said, "This is not my stop." And, of course, the door gunner pushed me out, and they did not want to stay long. So
no.
I found my duffel bag, and nobody was out. Then a hand comes up out of a bunker and says, "Hey, hey, you, hey," expletive.
Yes.
"Come over here, run, run, mother sticker."
Yeah.
and so I start running over there, and I hear this boom in the background, and everybody's underground, and those are 122 rockets or mortars coming off of Korok Mountain, which is right outside of Quezon.
Indeed.
But that was my introduction to Vietnam, really.
Oh, and the reason why the King Bee didn't stay very long is because at that point in time, during that Tet Offensive, any aircraft that landed there generated enemy gunfire, mortars, or in this case, 122 rockets.
At the airfield, you could see the remnants of a C-47 blown apart.
Whoa.
And you could see that on the ground. You knew that, hey, this is Indian territory. And I say that with respect to Indians.
Indeed.
We'll get into that later on if you want to.
We absolutely will. Talk a little bit more about the Comanche experience. But getting back to RT Idaho, ST Idaho, so you get back to Fubai, and somebody says through the process, introduces you to Glen Lane. How's that work?
The Sergeant Major...
This is all new to me, too.
Sergeant Major Enriquez at the time called us in, and he said, we had started off from the SFOB in Nha Trang. That was about 15 people. When I got up there, there was about four of us on a chopper. And the Sergeant Major said, any of you had any recon experience? And of course, I said, well, I was in a reconnaissance troop in the 49th Armored Division when it was activated at Fort Pope. And I have some experience in that. And I was also on a LERP with the 16th Infantry Rangers. And he was smiling, and he said, "We got a place for you, Spider."
Oh.
But anyway, it wasn't Spider at the time.
Right.
But I messed up. But Enriquez was a super sergeant major, as were all of them there that we had. Yeah.
So he then assigns you?
To RT Idaho.
Right. And
one of the former members had... gone on a mission and decided that it wasn't for him. And, of course, there was nothing derogatory, but they got him out of the FOB.
Post-haste.
Well, not soon enough till the Lane had to fill me in and said, hey, he's leaving, and
right.
Here's why. Anyway.
And, more importantly, you're on a team. You get introduced to the team. And between that time and May of 68, you ran several missions with Glen Lane as the 1-0.
No, I ran as the 1-1.
Yeah, Glen Lane was the 1-0,
yes.
You're the 1-1.
We had several Hey You missions. We had to experience before you got there. Had to fill in for a guy on the hatchet force. But I went on... two bright lights that I remember.
Well, two bright lights?
Yeah. One of them was down pilot right outside of Hanoi. And I think I gave a story about this in John Plaster's book about a MiG-21 flying underneath us. And,
no.
And one of the guys on sleep said, talking to Lane, said, "Lane, what would you do if you saw a MiG?" And he said, "Well, I'd shit." And he said, "Well, you better start because that's a MiG." Anyway, something to that tune. But I didn't really want to open up to John Plaster because I didn't know him.
Right.
But he was certainly a great covey rider and a 1-0 in his own right. And he did so much research there that I didn't feel the things I did were important enough to be in that book.
Well, and just for the record, we have interviewed John, and he will be on. He was on podcast number 11, Sogcast number 11, and yes, he did three tours of duty, and our listeners will enjoy that tape. But getting back to Spider Park story, so that's one bright light just outside of Hanoi. Were you able to get to the pilot?
We did.
No kidding.
We had a heavy team. We put up a, there was no one around it, and we couldn't get the pilot out. This is probably not appropriate to talk about, but we have things called crispy critters.
Right.
And that's what, you know, jet fuel can do. And if you want, you want to take parts of that human remains out of that cockpit, that would have been all we'd been able to do. And Lane chose not to do it. I believe it was appropriate.
Yeah, you're able to confirm the status of the pilot, which sadly...
The pilot was confirmed dead, and, you know, I don't know what the status that the family got, but...
Indeed.
Again, they have this status now with the DPAA that if confirmed dead, BNR, body not recovered, and the body may have not been... recovered because of the elements, because of
right,
because of the crispy critter mode, another great aviator, as you and I know, we'd be fertilizer in Southeast Asia if it wasn't for the great aviators.
Without a doubt. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Fearless.
I've talked too much. I'm sorry.
No, that's why you're here, because we're paying you the big bucks for that talk. And we appreciate that. And Jocko Productions appreciates you taking the time to talk to us today. Absolutely.
Well, I'd be glad to meet Jocko in the paycheck. Thank you.
Indeed. But I'd like to go back to the very beginning when you talked to your sergeant major and explained about your history a little bit, because this is a very unique time for your in your life. And you joined the Army around 56, 57?
50, end of 57, 58.
And just tell us a little bit about a couple of units. You had a very unique company commander at one point, but I wanted you to tell us about that so it's accurate.
Company commander?
Well, the 16th.
Yep,
some guy named Jack.
The guy was a battle group commander. He was a full colonel. He was an OSS combat veteran, a very famous general, Jack Sinclair.
Who lives in Franklin, Tennessee today.
Lives just in Franklin, Tennessee.
Just turned 100 years old
still,
last month.
Still alive. I worked for him at three different occasions during my 30 years of, or more or less. But I was in the Army Reserve when I came to Vietnam, which is not unique. And, of course, nowadays, I had volunteered to go back on active duty in 1967 to go through operations and intelligence school and get my full flash for Special Forces.
Right.
But it wasn't my first time with Special Forces or Rangers or Special Operations.
Indeed. So you had that earlier time with those companies, and that's what led to that experience that
yes,
brings you to Fort Bragg.
I was sent to Bad Tölz, Germany in 1959 as a commo person. And a long-range patrol type, ranger type.
And, of course, Bad Tölz at that time was the headquarters for 10th Special Forces
10th
Group.
10th Special Forces Group.
And the Cold War was in full...
Full swing. They had
indeed.
Det A in Berlin, and I was privy to all of that. And of course, Colonel Feisenheimer, I believe, was the group commander of the 10th Group. And there's some people that met me that are still alive. Another American Indian. I call him a drugstore Indian, but he's he's a that's Luke Emanuel. He knew me at 10th Group when a lot of people said Spider couldn't have been there. But anyway,
right.
So most of the things that are not easily explained can be backed up by by the appropriate liar.
But also, so you could talk to, you're not a store Indian. You're the real deal.
No, I'm not. I'm a part breed.
I
have lived on a reservation. I slept with the horses. I grew up and chewed that dirt with. But the reservation we're on no longer exists. It was kind of like a gypsy band. There were Comanches, Apaches, Navajos, Hoopies, Zunis, and all kinds of Mexican and Mexican Indians, who my first language was Comanche.
Indeed.
Second language was slang Spanish. Third language was broken English and profanity.
Indeed.
So, which I'm still proficient at.
Very proficient. And since then, you've also added how many more languages? Korean?
I learned German from being in Germany, and I went to a small German course. I went to the Defense Language Institute on three occasions. I learned Korean, limited fluency Russian,
wow,
and advanced Spanish.
Advanced.
Yeah.
And, you know, from that time on the reservation, that also led you to an experience where your time with horses and working with indigenous people really paid off. And this is like a little sidebar before we get back to Vietnam, but just one of those interesting stories where, because you grew up with horses, on one of your assignments, you were encountered horses. And could you just talk a little bit about that for a quick sidebar?
Okay. Well, I'll try to make it. We were in Colombia training the anti-terrorists in Bogota, Colombia, training the police and military. They had a stable there. We were doing a training exercise, and my commander was down there with us. And some of the people on our special ops team, that one of our companies had the same mission as the Delta Force has for the Central and South America. And many of them had some experience with horses. The sergeant major at that time, a friend of mine who went through O&I with me in 67, lost an eye in Vietnam with SOG, Francisco Medina.
I know that name.
We were pretty much accomplished horsemen, and several of the other guys were. But the other guys, they really couldn't go with us to help out with this exercise we were on. And that sort of bonded with the people we were working with in Bogota at that time.
And you're in the mountains. You're working with some local indigenous people there.
We had later on, and around, I was it in the 80s when the Palace of Justice came down. That contact that our company had with those people, and my commander, I'm not sure if this is still classified, but the takedown of the Palace of Justice, the 3rd of the 7th had a lot to do with that. So
indeed,
that, enough said.
Well, maybe we'll come back a little later, but here the key element was, on this exercise, you and a couple other special forces soldiers,
yes,
worked with the indigenous troops, and your experiences with horses helped you to ingratiate yourself as
Establish
a Green Beret
rapport
does.
Tilt.
Indeed. But that's just like one of the little sidebars.
Yeah,
but
well,
it's just,
you know, and that's not unheard of. The folks in Iraq and Afghanistan, some of the reserve special forces guys were really into that the horse soldiers.
Indeed.
And my heart goes out to them. They're, you know, I salute them.
Yeah, whereas the majority of the people in the horse soldier story, they weren't horsemen. You guys were, and it helped to ingratiate you with the people you were working with.
I think some of those guys were horsemen.
They had
skills.
There were a few.
But I must tell you this. My father was in the horse cavalry. He was in the old guard.
Is that right?
Yes. That's right.
Tell me more. Old guard?
Arlington Cemetery, but he was in the horse cavalry. Of course, our family is so dysfunctional, which nowadays that's a mental health term.
Indeed.
But it's appropriate.
Indeed. But so we took that little sidebar. So let's get back to Vietnam, back to FOB1. STRT Idaho is now missing in action. They come to you, say, Spider, you're not going to go to Khantoum. We're going to make you to 10 of Idaho. And that's where you and I met, or we met, actually.
Let's back up a little.
Let's back up. That's why I pay you the big bucks.
Colonel Shelton, Colonel Roy Barr, Major Jacks, Major Clyde Sincere said, Spider, you want to keep Idaho, or the name of Idaho, and stay on Idaho, or you want to change the name? I went to the interpreter, because here's the word, and I'll say this a little bit. I had some notes here, but I've had a charmed life. So has Hip, our interpreter. He and I, for some reason, he wasn't on that mission. I was not on that mission. And the other folks that are assigned to Idaho, Sal and Fook, people right. that you met later on, they determined that Spider's lucky. He ain't good, but he's lucky. And of course, they knew that I had some recon skills, because I believe I did.
You did.
And we improved on the SOP that Lane had so hardly worked on, or not hardly worked on, but so worked on so hard. And one of the things that we always, all of the teams that networked together and got in, after duty or when appropriate to think about, hey, what works in the bush, man? What are you doing right?
Right.
And we shared those things.
And that would be the main sharing ground would be the clubhouse.
Yeah, or the mess hall.
On FOB1. Or a mess hall, sure.
The mess hall, and or out there in the company gravel pit or yard, the firing range, wherever. But we shared that information. And one of the things was, stay off trails, you know.
Yeah, that's the golden rule.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that later on.
Sure.
But at any rate, we came back. I took Hep with me, and I said, hey, hell no, we're keeping Idaho. Idaho's our team, and we're going to keep it. And then a few days later, you came in, or you were already there. You passed RT Idaho going out on that mission. You might want to talk about that.
Well, we've mentioned it before quickly. When I landed at FOB1, me, Johnny McIntyre, and John Hutchins, the three of us, Kingbee came in, landed. And, of course, that was our first time we ever flew in at Kingbee. And they gave us that initiation, come up Highway 1 heading north, flip it on its side. It's like, holy shit, what's going on? But we survived that. We landed. Idaho gets on and disappears into history, SOG history. A tragic chapter therein. And so they disappear. They attempt to find them. They can't. The bright light gets shot up. You're on the ground with shrapnel wounds, etc. And then you become the 10. And the thing I remember is that training. You and, of course, Don Wolken was the assistant team leader. And he came on the team. And that's when we started all that training. And you just worked us. Worked us hard. Then we had the monsoons, the bags, and then we did a practice mission, a night ambush, and then we had our first real mission where you're the 10, and they augmented the team to insert Air Force sensors into the Ashaw.
We had one more prior to that. Remember
which one?
When they sent that team in with us, they got in a firefight.
Well, you told me that was a practice mission. It wasn't for real.
It was real.
It was on the east side of
Yashron Valley. No, it was real. But you done good, boy.
I may be slow, but I got there.
Yes.
And the other team that was parallel to us, they ambushed the Pathet Lao ambush.
They got run out.
After they ambushed the ambush?
They got run out, and we stayed in another couple of nights. And the head chef thought we were great, but we were just moving around in place and not really moving too far. But we were told just go in there and area recon. We did have a little. Remember that area we landed on where we won't go into any more about that.
But it was a
big open area, and they had something like a gravel road. We watched that road a little bit.
We did. I remember that part. And then that was my first exposure to Laotian mosquitoes. When in the morning I could barely open my eyes. I had been eaten alive by the mosquitoes that
well,
night.
Well, you guys from New Jersey just didn't have it all together.
We didn't. We're just city slickers. So after that first successful mission, which I thought was a practice mission all those years, thank you for the clarification, Sergeant. Then the Air Force sensors. And that mission, you were the 1-0, augmented with Les Daniels from RT Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Bob Ross came in from S3. And I forget why. Those two gentlemen had worked with the equipment, and they were there to augment the team. But you were the 1-0, took us in, and maybe talk a little bit about what that mission was. We had the main computer, everything was buried, and then two more coaxial cables that went out to lesser sensors that could pick up motion on the trail.
Well, that's why Ross and I believe, I don't know if it's Hal Falk, the other guy, but
Les Daniels.
Les Daniels was with us to insert.
Right, okay.
But we inserted them. They turned them on and made sure that we didn't screw them up.
Right.
And they were out there, to do that. But they said, Spider, you're going to be in charge. You're going to be the 1-0. I said, okay. I said, I'd rather not go out with someone, that maybe their first, second mission on the ground or whatever. But Ross and Falk were great people, and they helped us. But you remember when we buried those things, there was an antenna sticking up.
Right.
And the reason we didn't get killed on the way in is because they couldn't lower the AA guns low enough. They thought the 101st was coming in, and they were going to be coming in at 3,000.
That right?
That's the reason. We came in right off the... And remember, you guys had your last rites the night before, because we're going to land on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
We were pretty certain that we were going to be dead within 24 hours.
Yeah, and the reason we got in and is out is because we came in low.
And that was with the first cav on that mission.
No, that was the 101st. The choppers might have been from the first cav.
Okay.
But the 101st came in, and remember, we went up to LZ Bastogne.
Right.
We laid there, and we were panting, drinking water. And here's the funny story that I remember. They had a tent up there, and here comes this captain with a flak jacket and a steel pot and running over to where we were laying there on the ground, getting our breaths back, said, "Who are these people? Where are your steel pots? Where are your flak jackets? My God, you haven't shaved." Who's in charge here? And I believe it was you. That'd be Spider. He said, "Spider, who is Spider?" And anyway, I get up. I didn't call him sir or anything. We were in sterile fatigues. And he looked around at all our little people with gold teeth and better weapons than they had.
Absolutely.
The Car 15s.
Yeah.
And he said, "Who, what, what's going on? Who's in charge here? And then here comes a major out of the headquarters, says, where's Spider? General Zeiss wants to talk to Spider. And then this captain almost locked his heels. He said, so I went over there, and what he's telling me, he said, maybe 5 minutes after you put those sensors in, we started picking up transmissions. I don't know if they were deer or rabbits or NVA coming, but we got, said, you guys did a great job. Get on out of here. But that was the 101st Commander.
Whoa. You know, I'd forgotten that completely.
Yeah, well, don't you remember that?
Not at all. I'm still recovering. Over.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe it wasn't you.
It may not have been. May have been another white guy.
Might have been Daniels. But see, Daniels is another American Indian. He's a great Ute.
Is that right?
Yep, right out of Colorado. I got to link up with him later on. So.
Oh, no kidding. Because Les Daniels was, for the record, probably one of, if not the best 1-0s in camp.
Better than me.
Oh, better than all of us, for sure. Great guy. So then in September, Idaho put in another set of sensors up by Quezon. I forget, were you the 1-0 for that?
No, by that time it was Don. No, it must have been Don Walken.
Okay.
Or you.
No, not me. It was Don, because that was September up by Highway 9.
Idaho became sort of use your best donkeys and guys that seem to have a charmed existence.
Well, we ran that mission, and also during that time we had some monsoons, so the team was inactive, a lot of duty in the camp, and then finally we come to October the 5th when ST Alabama is inserted. And they had an inexperienced 1-0 team leader, and they went in with a 9-man team. The second helicopter went in with Lynn Black and some indigenous troops from ST Alabama. And Lynn told the inexperienced 1-0, there's a NVA flag here. It's at least a battalion. We're 9. We should leave now. The Vietnamese team members told the 1-0, we should leave now. He said no. And then he committed the mortal sin, which we referenced earlier. He walked down. He led the team down a trail. They walked into an L-shaped ambush where they were ambushed by 50 NVA, killing 2 members of the team right away. The team leader, who made the wrong decision, and tragically a really good point man, was killed instantly. Firefight went on. It commenced all day. And at this point, yourself and Spider Parks, you are. Pat Watkins were flying Covey that day for the entire day, relaying commo from the team on the ground with Lynn Black talking to you, and you and or Pat Watkins directing airstrikes all day. And we've talked about it a little bit in the book, Across the Fence, but for you, what are a couple things that stick out in your mind? And then I think it was near the end of the day, you had one of those moments in life that you'll never forget, where you almost had a mid-air collision.
Well, first of all, Tilt, I was flying Covey. We were both out there. I was a Covey rider. I'm not a Covey pilot. Covey pilots could do everything that Covey riders could do and more. But here's the thing. Pat was I believe he was with Covey 256, maybe 254. They were about bingo on gas, and they couldn't stay as long.
And bingo means low on fuel.
Yeah. Anyway, we had told James Stride and go out on a VR and you pick your own LZ. Don't pick the one that's been appointed for you. And we think that there's a mole somewhere. And we shared that information. I said,
even that early in May, 68. Wow.
But even the fact that he did not want to listen. It was really detrimental to what happened to the, you know, to that team. And then I got the I got on the horn or on the Fox Mike radio with Lynn Black, and he's saying the 1-2 is down. I think he's dead. And then Lynn will tell you this, that I told him, I said, well, check him out. I said, you're not a medic, are you? Not. Anyway, come to find out he wasn't. He was not dead. He was praying. And, of course, that's not the time. You need to put that in a different compartment to get on. But there are so many things that went wrong. The weather was bad. They went in a hole, and aircraft was stacked up high, and that's why we almost had a mid-air collision with too many aircraft in there. And of course, Pat Watkins and I were both over Jolly Green 1-0, which was piloted by a pilot from the great services known as the Coast Guard. And we watched that B-40 rocket as it went into that chopper, did a dive, flipped over and crashed into the jungle. And the IRC-10 radio, the emergency radio, came up. I thought no one could have survived that crash. And it was the PJ off of Jolly Green 1-0.
Wow, yeah.
And, of course, that story in your book takes up a lot of appropriate time to deal with it correctly. And I'll never forget that day, but never forget the day that Lane and Owen were missing. There's several other turning points, Marble Mountain, of course, and New Year's Day. Seems like a lot of things happened.
If we could, I agree. We're going to go to each one of those. So, but the specificity for that one moment in time, people hear about TACAIR, air cover, working it, how difficult it is, and like you said, on that day, the team was in trouble early in the morning. They were on the ground the entire day until you all got them out. You and Pat working with all the air assets, which includes A-1 Sky Raiders, Air Force Fast Movers. We lost another King Bee. That Jolly Green went down. A second Jolly Green was shot up so bad that after they extracted the team.
An F-4.
And did they lose an F-4?
I believe they did. But we got them out at last light.
Right.
Watkins had to go back for gas, if you remember.
Absolutely.
Yep. But Watkins is much better Covey rider than me. He's the one I hate for hate and love, but he recommended that I leave the team and be a Covey rider.
But for the record, you two both were outstanding Covey riders. So from being on the ground, talking to you all, saving our bacon, I can say that for the record. But the moment in time on that mission for you, at one point, you and your pilot almost had a mid-air collision.
Yes.
With an F-4.
An F-4 turned us on our side and loosened the Marken rockets on my side of the airplane. They had rockets, but the rocket pod was useless after we landed, and I don't know how it stayed on. But yes, it was close.
And it was that close because people don't realize with a jet moving several hundred miles an hour past you, just the force of that air alone, not only did your aircraft bounce, but it was damaged.
Yes.
And, okay, so that's a moment in time. So as part of your history, on August the 22nd, you were down in Da Nang for a promotion board. And this led to a major, we didn't realize it on the 22nd, but in the early morning hours of the 23rd, there was a severe attack on FOB-4 in Da Nang, and you had gone downtown to our safe house that night, and you came back in the morning to see the carnage.
Yes.
And if you could talk a little bit about how after the Viet Cong and NVA sappers had planned an attack for over a year, they launched it in the early morning, no moonlight, and they ultimately killed 16 Green Berets at that base and others. And we lost dozens of indigenous, and the NVA that came in wore headbands and said, "We came to die," and they did. And so after that night of fighting, you came in. What did you see at FOB 4?
Well, we were at House 22, which was a safe house. They were showing a movie at FOB 4, and I told Pat Watkins that we ran to the transit hooches, which were partially being built, but we wanted to get close to the shower. The rooms closest to the shower were already occupied. One of the rooms that we liked when we were down there, we stayed at before, was near the shower, and Lieutenant Potter was already in there.
Oh,
and
really?
A couple of the others, yeah. Well, that is like having a charmed life, because that room was destroyed and Lieutenant Potter was killed.
In his bed.
In his bed right there at that point. But we moved down the hall and I put my rucksack in there, and then I said, "Hey,
Pat."
Yep. I said, "Hey, Pat, why don't you let me take your your Swedish K automatic 9mm with me, because, you know, I'm going down there and there's some bad guys out that way." I said, "You guys are going to be here, you know." And he had a 45 caliber pistol. I had a 38, because it was in my Air Force flight vest. And I was hey-you'd when I got back off a mission, said, "You're going down to the promotion board." And of course, I didn't get to bring any clean fatigues or anything down there. I usually carried my Car 15 and hand grenades and all that, like down there with a 38 and six loose rounds. And,
oh.
I had Watkins two magazines and a Swedish K.
Yeah.
So I took that down at about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. A couple of guys tried to get in the House 22, and the gate guards there fired them up. Then we got the word that FOB 4 and CCN was under fire. We got on a 3/4 ton and drove to there as morning was breaking, and they let us in. We went up by the dispensary where people were laid out there. There was still fire. There were still sappers. We went down the fence line. I ran into Watkins, and of course he hugged me, and then wanted to strangle me because I had his automatic weapon.
He had to use his 45.
Yeah. What happened to Watkins and Varney? Varney was on the chopper with us. They were smart enough to hide behind their mattresses when the sapper rolled a hand grenade down the hallway and blew it in, and then Pat went outside and killed that sapper with his 45. Then they got behind some sand piles or sandbags, and then Watkins told me that they were getting fire from the commo bunker. And there was a Captain Pfeiffer who had thrown a grenade over maybe 50 yards.
Long distance. He had a strong arm.
And Varney had got up to tell the people inside the combo barkers, "Hey, we're Americans," but they were already sappers in there, and he got shot. So he was killed. Watkins and I went on down after sunrise. We were down just before sunrise, I guess. There was two NVA sappers in their loincloths, and they were in our latrines.
Right.
Our wooden, you know,
latrine.
Latrines.
Yeah.
and they had locked arms, and they were getting fired up. I believe Doug Gottschall had walked down there with us, because we were picking up stragglers. There was no organized defense as you would have it, and Watkins took charge of that. He said, "Hey, we're going to go here. We got to prepare for a counterattack." Nobody thought, I didn't think about a counterattack, but he did. And he said, "We're going to." We took these stragglers down and firing inside that shitter.
Yeah.
And it blew apart. They had laid together and pulled the pin on a hand grenade and killed themselves. Now, those guys were dedicated. They were, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, to them, that was their mission, and it was worth dying for. We can, you know, we were doing the same things. We didn't want to die, but, you know, when it come to it, you know, you and I, we had our SOP. We had our final rounds. We had our
less
9mm. We had our hand grenades. And, you know, not going to be taken alive. So
no.
That when you fighting those kind of people, I mean, grudgingly, respect that, hey, they did what they were fighting for. However, you know, why didn't I have no remorse in squeezing the trigger?
None.
So, yes, that.
So you're there for that historic moment.
Yes,
for you're that, there with Lynn Black on October
the
5th.
I should have been there, but I would have probably been in Lieutenant Potter's bunk. But anyway, I believe I've had a charmed life.
Without a question. And then 2 days after October 5th, I'm biased on this, just to wander for a second, you and Pat Watkins, again, as Cubby Riders, were over our team when we finally made contact with you all, and you provided great coverage for us, coordinated the air, and again, we got out last night with Captain Tin pulling us out. And then other moments in time, which would include Christmas Day, which was one of the most unusual transmissions I ever had. I was on the ground, we're in contact, and you said, "We got an intel report. Do not go to the Northeast." And you had talked to the Frenchman.
Yes, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, he said, don't move a hair. Tell those guys, just don't tell them why, because, you know, another thing that we didn't pay enough attention to is the ability of the NVA to RDF. They were masters at that. You know, after a few transmissions, were able to get...
And the RDF is radio direction finders.
Yeah.
So they were able to triangulate. If you were on the FM radio for just a short amount of time, like Doug's case, he wanted to remain clandestine.
Mm-hmm. Well, he gave me the right info, and he said, "Just relay it." And I said, "Yes, sir, private." You and Doug Letourneau are private PFCs.
Right. So we'll go fast ahead for 1 week. On New Year's Eve, 68, team is inserted. You went out, gave them a team okay. You came back a little bit concerned because it was New Year's Eve. We won't talk about your concerns, but you came back, and in the morning, you flew out early again to check in with the team. And that was where was one of the first times we had a recon team on the ground hit by sappers.
Yeah.
And so, again, this is another one of those sad but historic moments. So you're directly involved.
I was on the radio with, I believe that was LeBone. Or who is the other? But
Hawes and Hall.
Hawes.
Because we knew Hawes from...
They were Canadians.
They were. Yeah.
But he said, "Wait," and I heard AK fire in the background, and I just started shaking my head because I never got another transmission from him.
Wow.
And that's where the whole team... there were no Indige killed. Is that right?
Yeah. Correct.
Yep. And that fine crew chief from the 101st that went down on the string and tied the bodies.
No, I'd forgotten that part.
Well, they took them down to to
Da Nang.
To FOB 4 and remember
Colonel Warren.
We've got too many stories. Yeah.
Well, these are the SOG stories that you were directly involved in.
Yes.
And more. And so we've gone through some of that. And so for your remaining tour of duty, you and I were together at FOB 4 at CCN after they closed FOB 1. But I seldom saw you because you're busy doing what down there? You're wrapping up your tour of duty. And
up on Chin Strap, up there where Larry Trimble's team was up there, and I was up there with another FOB. I didn't want to hang around the head shed. I thought I'd get hey-you'd again.
Indeed.
And you know what hey-you is for our audience is, you know, you're standing around doing nothing, and you can explain it better than me, but you've been hey-you'd.
Yeah, hey-you. You got to.
You have too, Tom.
Voluntold.
And so from here, I'd like to go back to something we skirted over when you were talking. Maybe we can't go into too much detail now, but when you were in Bogota, there was another, this is a changing gears. We're going from SOG now to years later. You're in Bogota, and you quickly mentioned the Hall of Justice had been overrun by terrorists. And you were there at that moment in time. Could you talk just a little?
I wasn't there when it happened, but I got there later on. It's kind of like when I got into FOB 4, you know, Charmed Life.
Indeed. But that was a moment in time where were you still with the 3rd or 7th then?
The 37th.
Okay. And so you're down there, and that was where the terrorists took over the Hall of Justice in Bogota.
They killed the justices, yes.
Wow. They
executed. I don't know how many Supreme Court justices, but of the assignments I've had, the 3rd or the 7th and the duty up in El Salvador, either other countries training their armies, training their civilian defense forces, going to Argentina, getting to travel on the parachute team to every country in Central and South America except Chile. The 3rd of the 7th of the two tours I had there, the tour in the first group, in the first of the first in Okinawa, finest assignments I've had except for the one at Fubai.
Yeah, that was a little different, that's for sure.
A little different.
But nonetheless, that's a special forces career that's really, you're too modest to say it, but I'll say it, is exemplary. And that's why we're here today. I'm just honored to have you with us to talk about that. And, you know, during that time, you also spent some time in Korea. And I remember there was at least one poster that was made from May 6th, like 98 or 99, when you had participated and a major jump. Your jump demonstration team had jumped into Korea. And you had talked a little bit about your time in Korea with another unique assignment.
Well, I left Panama just before Just Cause.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And by the way, one of my acquaintances, one of my jump personnel or jump trainees was Manuel Noriega. I have pictures of that to prove that. But Manuel was a skydiver, and he loaned us his aircraft for weekend practice jumps along with the Panamanian jump team.
Really?
Yes. But I'd also had made friends with some famous skydivers in Korea, and we had a Commander's Cup jump in Korea. I got to meet a lot of Korean high-ranking officers and their special warfare folks. And, of course, SFDK, Special Forces Detachment Korea, took me under their wing and allowed me to jump with them as a reservist. So a retired reservist. Anyway.
Yes, indeed.
I hope that wouldn't compromise any of the people in that time frame. But I was assigned as the garrison sergeant major, as a command sergeant major, Camp Page, Korea. And they had a fine compound there. Then later on, after I retired, I became a garrison commander of Camp Hialeah in Busan, Korea. So,
wow.
But those are too long of stories, and it just, you know, some of the guys in Alabama said, "Hey, Spider, you Forrest Gump." And I said, anyway, I said, "I can back it up." Okay.
Indeed.
But I'm about worn out. Let's wind this thing up, Till.
Well, we will in a few minutes here. But, you know, I think that after your time in the Army, it was also a period where your service to our country and then to veterans, where you went on to get hired, get edumacated. You became a Dr. Parks, and then you worked with the VA for 15 years working with veterans.
Well, I didn't work with the VA. I worked for the Department of Army as a behavioral scientist, a substance abuse professional, testing, training, education, and therapy. But that took a long time. But remember this, I came back in the Army. I was on my way to be a public health professional. I had served in every department of the Dallas City and County.
This is before active duty, yes.
Before I came back on 67 to go get my, the toughest course I ever took was the Special Forces O&I. But I was going to school at night. The department was educating me and grooming me to be a public health officer. I worked with meat, milk, food investigation, animal control,
right,
vector control, VD investigation.
Really?
Yes, really. And it was it was an interesting occupation.
Indeed.
I had planned to go do a year in Vietnam and come back to the health department. But something happened, the bonding, the fellowship, and knowing that I get to travel, I get to go to language school, I get all this. I'm not going back to Dallas, Texas. And here's another thing. I was born at the hospital that John F. Kennedy died at.
Parkland.
Parkland Hospital. I was downtown in City Hall when he got shot.
Really?
Yes. And one of the officers that got killed was a high school friend of mine. And in 1980-81, his son was in my company in the 82nd Airborne when I was the first sergeant in the 82nd. And
wow.
He was killed by his wife. So,
oh,
wow, this...
The story could go on. So the 82nd was part of your career.
Yes.
So you ultimately became, you became a command sergeant major. And how many different posts did you actually serve as a command sergeant major?
Actually, Panama and Korea, Camp Page, and a third of the 7th in Panama. That's the only two.
Only two, yeah.
Only two.
Yeah, it's outstanding. And the modesty factor here. And then continuing on, the last 15 years through your American Legion post in Huntsville, again, you're on a special detail there where you continue to go to honor our veterans when they pass away. In fact, you had a funeral yesterday, did you not? Or 2 days ago?
Day before yesterday, yes.
Yes, sir.
In the 13 years, we've done over 1,200 funerals for veterans. I serve as the deputy commander of the Post 237 American Legion Honor Guard.
Indeed. And
and I'm also on the POW/MIA team for the Joint Special Operations. Yes. Hey, I got too many stories.
Well, we're not complaining about that. And then... the other side of the spider coin that we didn't talk about at all too was you've played a little sports in your day. So even when you're in high school, in ninth grade, because back in your school, as a way they were transitioning to a new high school, you as a ninth grader wound up in high school and you were on the football team and you went on to have a career in athletics. That's where we met, playing softball. But still, you've played football, baseball, and many years playing fast pitch long after most fast pitchers have retired.
I played baseball in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
To play. Played on a minor league baseball team in Korea up until my late 60s.
Wow.
So, well, mid-60s. Played on semi-pro football team in Pittsburgh Leominster their first year.
Was that right?
Yep.
We were at 10th group at Fort Devens.
Yep, that's right.
Indeed.
They played teams like the Long Island Bulls, the played Park League teams in Boston, and the prison team. I remember that out in Concord. So, yeah, it's been a wonderful life, Till.
It has. And you're a part of a very unique niche in history. During an 8-year secret war, you served in that war for your year, put your time in, with many amazing stories. And there are people that are alive today thanks to your service, you and Pat Watkins, when you're flying as Covey riders. And I know that you're inclined to wrap it up here, but as we do so, as you reflect back on those years, you've also had a personal effort. I don't know how much detail we can go into, but for example, the hat you're wearing today is unique because that hat has traveled with you. It's a Special Operations Association hat that has traveled with you when you went to Laos, when you returned to Vietnam. And an effort to try to help any way at all to locate our team members, and at least the remains. And you traveled at least back there once with Tony Harrell.
Yes.
And if you could maybe just talk a little bit about that, because that gives a reflection of your commitment and devotion to our teammates that we lost in 1968.
Well, of course, the haunting experience and the personal passion that I have for wanting to find the guy that replaced me when I should have been on that mission, and Glenn Lane, what a great base he gave me to be a 1-0. That's a passion that I can't deny, and I have been able to travel many times due to my health and due to having made enough money and having enough funds donated to allow me to travel. And I have a couple of businesses, one in the Philippines and one in Korea, and I've had help from many different people over there. I have decided that I want to dedicate my life to humanitarian efforts, and instead of trying to bomb and kill people, but I can go into that as philosophically, but that would take probably the rest of the day, Till, and we need to wrap it up.
We do, and but also from a first-hand basis, you and I were together in the Ashaw Valley, and you have since returned there, where now there's a hotel.
Yes.
Yeah. <that's, laughs> That used to be a Green Beret A camp. They now have a hotel.
Yeah, the Alui Airfield and Tabat Airfield. I've crash-landed on Alui, and you can see that from the weekend market where the hotel is in the Ashaw Valley.
Really?
And they've got paved parts of the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
No.
Yes.
Now, you said you crash landed there in an '02?
Yes. The front engine was shot out.
Just another day in the Secret War.
Another day in Nam, man.
Indeed. And then also, as we close out, you have dabbled with music.
A little bit.
And you've put together a couple songs that, although we're not, we may not have the link today, but we'll post it, where people can go to songs that you've composed. And that music, you've tied it into SOG and a couple to Recon. And who is the story about you gaining some of your early inspiration for music came in 1968 and from two unique men. Could you just, before we wrap up, could you share a little bit of that? And then how, we, if people are interested in Spider songs, where we can lead them to at some point.
Well, Tilt, you were in that room with me when we were playing the guitars. You remember the chaplain played guitars.
I remember.
Grady Spry, famous airborne chaplain, used to drink a six-pack of beer and play
that.
Country Western. Of course, I was interested in country Western and rock. But there
well,
were
see, don't forget, back then, the headsets were only 1 year.
Yeah.
So in 1 year, I had the Vanilla Fudge and the Cream and the Doors. And other year, I'm listening to you guys do country western. So I had a very dichotomous musical experience,
you know,
thanks
I played
to you.
More country, rather more rock and roll.
Indeed.
These two gentlemen who are younger than me, younger than you, I believe, Stan... Seating and
Richard Fitz, who took money from me in a poker game, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah.
Well, his son became a rock star.
Richard Fitz Jr.
Yeah, and I played with him also.
Is that right?
At SOAR, you saw me sitting over there.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah,
I'm not good in this long-term memory.
Richard Fitz could play the guitar and sing.
Yes.
Stan Seating, likewise. And we played rock songs, and we changed the words to them because you were in the Nam, man. We're in Vietnam.
Yeah.
But the high heel sneakers, you know.
So give us a little bit of a hint of that. So from high heel sneakers, instead of putting on your high heel sneakers, you put on a...
Put on your flak jacket, brother, because we're going down the trail. Or we're going out tonight. Put on your steel pot, brothers, because we're going out to fight. And we put that to the tune of Put On Your High Heel Sneakers.
Indeed.
And the other song I kind of put in one of a progression of chords that I used for the Black Rifle Coffee song.
That's right. I forgot about
but
that.
But I had that progression for Don't Go Down That Trail, It's a Highway to Hell. And you know, that's part of our SOP. Don't go down any trail.
That's right.
Don't cut down no grass. It might show where we passed, you know. But stuff like that. That sort of, you know, I've had a penchant for that. I'm not any good. I got a scratchy a voice and an out-of-tune guitar.
But maybe we'll have to connect you with the folks that put together the SOG video game. SOG Prairie Fire video game, because they're always looking for music.
Well, that, you know,
I think your music might be a good fit there. I hadn't thought about that.
My musician partner and the brains of the outfit, Randy Gray, was an Army musician. He's been on the honor guard for Post 229. We have combined because we don't have enough old people to do funerals.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well.
And so what we'll do is
I'll play you a couple of songs when we get through here.
Very good. And then what we'll do is we'll get that music and get the word out. And I will talk to people from Savage Games that put together the SOG Prairie Fire video game that's now out on the market based off and pays homage to SOG and the men that were in it. And we will go forward with that from there.
This should be a tribute to the memory of Stan Seating and Richard Fitz. Randy and I are not doing this for money. We're doing it for historical preservation.
Indeed. And we have to say that Richard Fitz was one of seven Green Berets who were killed November 30th, 1968. They were on an Elder Son mission, which was a mission.
Arthur Bader.
Art Bader was there from New Jersey. He's the man I remember the most. I remember Fitz because he took money from me in a poker game.
Yeah.
But Art Bader, I remember him because of his New Jersey link.
And he was in 67 and with us at Fort Bragg also.
Is that right? See, I'd forgotten that. But
yep.
On
I got
that
him
mission,
out of jail.
I'd forgotten that too. So what we have, so on that mission though, November 30th, Richard Fitz went down with a King Bee. And their remains weren't recovered until 20 plus years later. But they're now resting at
Arlington.
Let's
talk about Richard's Jr. or Richard's son. He has a video and he has a memorial to that. It's called 23 Years and a Folded Flag,
right.
Something like that. And we may see him this October.
We hope so at the Special Operations Association reunion in Vegas. And before we have a final, any final closing thoughts from you, sir?
Thank you.
And with that, we want to thank all the veterans out there today. Men like Robert J. Spider Parks, who fought for the ideals of our country. Truly an American hero. To those of you out there on the front lines now, we thank you for fighting for all that we care for and for our values today. And this recording is September the 2nd, and it's been a more difficult time in our country's history with Afghanistan and the families that are caught up in all of this. Our service members, we pay special tribute to them, as well as all of our service members, police, law enforcement, Border Patrol, Secret Service. And we want to thanks to all who live, and for those who did not return, we have a special salute for them, and for those that didn't come home. And today we close out. Again, we thank Spider Parks. Thank you for your service to our country, sir, and to all our people out there today. God bless America.
Amen.
And now for one of my favorite duties with our top secret agent, our technician, Tom, who we can't reveal his identity because obvious reasons, he's just too busy these days. But most importantly, we're here now to talk about Sogcast number 12 with one of my all-time brothers, friend, man, mentor, et cetera, Robert J. Spider Parks. So what was your impression, sir, for the first time to meet the live and live, our living legend?
It was amazing. As usual, meeting any of the guys from SOG for me, but Spider especially, because I've read so many books, and everywhere in there, in every book I think I've read, is Spider Parks, and it was like meeting a legend. You know, it's like I've met him. Here's the legend. You know, and it's great. It's heroes like him, and yourself, and the others that were with you, that you know. Is a reason that people do what they do, you know, and it's inspirational that he continues, you know, all the stuff that he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, like he served in the Army for 30 years. He doesn't even hardly talk or want to talk about it. And yeah, we barely scratched the surface, but I figure it's better to scratch the surface than not to get on the surface at all.
Yeah, you know, and I know it's got to be hard, even still to this day, for him to talk about with George. And it was interesting to get the confirmation. So if you haven't listened to Sogcast 01, if you haven't listened to that one, listen to that one, and then listen to this one, and you'll see that they tie together. So it's it's definitely, I know that's got to be difficult losing, you know, the team that you were actually on. Not even gone from yet, but on. And they went out, and then you never saw him again. So I think it's, you know, that's a hard part. It's discussing that. So it was good that he gave some insight into it and his experiences with it. Obviously, we heard from the troll, Mr. George Sternberg, and what his actions were like on the ground. So it's interesting to see that.
Well, yeah. And how many people, I think we can count them on about one hand, how many people actually ran recon with a team, lost a team, or like with Jim Shorten Jones, who we had Sogcast number two or three?
Two.
And he had that bright light where he wasn't able to get to the Air Force F-4. And years later, he went back on his own dime, got chased off. Then he went in with DPAA, helped them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, DPAA, being the scumbags they are, screwed him, went back one more time, never took him, never had the courtesy to call. Yeah. But Spider is one of the few that's been back.
Yeah.
More than once, physically on the LZ where the team disappeared, or where the bright light was shot up. And where
Is he going back again? I thought you had said he was trying to. I don't know, with everything that's happening in the world.
Yeah, I think there's always the desire to go back, and with world events, the virus, et cetera. Yeah. And I know he had to cancel at least one trip because of the virus.
Yeah.
He had everything set up, tickets purchased, hotel rooms rented. And just the thought of the Ashaw Valley with hotels in it was just kind of crazy.
Maybe the casino, you should go there and gamble.
Oh, yeah.
You guys already gambled there in the Ashaw Valley, like, right? You gamble with your life. Now you can gamble with some money, something that's not as bad.
Yeah. And then the parts of SOG history that he participated in.
Yeah.
Good God. And, anyways, any other closing thoughts from you observing one of our SOG legends?
No, just, again, it's such an honor to be able to sit here and do nothing to listen to this. So, the only thing I have to say is to all the families that are out there right now.
Indeed.
Obviously this will post later, but you know, there's people still fighting for you. So always keep that going, you know, keep hope. That's all you could say. And, you know, there's always people trying to help and, you know, keep that hope that they're going to help you.
Indeed. Well, thank you, sir. And thank you for helping today. And with that, one more time, we want to thank Jocko Echo Charles and his team for productions, for doing our SOGcast. Without them, we couldn't do it. And like you said, this particular moment in time, September 2nd, 2021, it's a unique moment in our country's history. And any of the families that hear this, you will remain in our prayers. The 13 families that paid the supreme price, that became Gold Star families, you will remain in our thoughts and prayers. You will not be forgotten. As we move forward, we thank those who are putting their lives on the line every day for our country. And last but not least, with September, the third Friday of September is the National POW MIA Recognition Day, where from the Vietnam War, we've had that recognition day that's been a part of our history, often not given much attention, but the League of POW/MIA Families always does so. And if you're ever looking for donations to help, they still are there. They work with our government. They pressure the government. They work with the communists in an effort to help to return, locate, find, and return to our country the 1,583 people, service members that are missing in action from the Vietnam War, which includes Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, North Vietnam, Thailand, and China. There's a few there. And with that thought, we want to salute those who did not come home and hope we continue to bring more remains back. Thank you to Jocko and his team. God bless America.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.